Beethoven and Sibelius with Kirsten Long. Program notes written by Jeff Wall, read by Sasha Gorbaso. Ludwig van Beethoven, 1770 to 1827. Concerto for violin and orchestra in D major, Opus 61. History does not record whether Beethoven was present at the first performance of this concerto in December 1806, though it seems likely. The violinist was the virtuoso Franz Clément, and the concert was for his benefit. But one wonders what might have passed through the great composer's mind as, between the first and second movements, Clément performed his own sonata on one string, with the violin held upside down. The audience ate it up, though. This was probably what most had actually come for. They even extended their lukewarm approval to what is arguably the greatest violin concerto ever written. Whatever he thought, Beethoven, a longtime admirer of Clément, remained on good terms with him for the rest of his life. Beethoven's sketchbooks reveal he interrupted work on the Fifth Symphony, then well underway, to write a concerto out of clemency for Clément. This pun, written in the manuscript, implies that the violinist was pressed to find a suitable piece for his concert. Certainly, Beethoven was pressed. Apparently, Clément had virtually to sight-read the barely completed finale. In its first movement, the concerto, like the symphony, is preoccupied with a single rhythmic figure. In this case, the five notes stated at the outset, unconventionally by the timpani. The movement's dimensions are unprecedented. By itself, it is nearly the length of a Mozart concerto, and the violin's highest tessitura is exploited to an unusual degree outside of virtuoso display pieces, perhaps reflecting Clément's particular abilities. As in all Beethoven's mature concertos, the soloist continues after the cadenza, tonight by Fritz Kreisler. Part of the magic of this coda lies in its being the violinist's only complete presentation of any of the main themes. The rest of his part being essentially elaboration of the orchestral line. The slow movement, a timeless set of variations, passes without pause into the rondo, a feature typical of many of Beethoven's compositions at this time. The finale's coda is notable for using the cadenza closing trill to move to A flat major, the remotest key possible from D. This excursion gives the eventual return of the home tonality, main theme in the oboe, an added satisfaction. Although it was published in 1808 in both its original format and in a transcription for piano and orchestra, Opus 61A, commissioned in 1807 by the pianist and publisher Muzio Clementi, who had pronounced the violin version beautiful. The Beethoven concerto was neglected after its premiere. It seems to have been considered old-fashioned. Not only were the latest pyrotechnics missing, but Beethoven's early biographer, Anton Schindler, refers to its artistic peculiarities. Use of short bow strokes following the old Italian school of Nardini and Tartini. There were performances by the French master, Pierre Bayeux, in Paris in 1828, and the 14-year-old Belgian virtuoso, Henri Vieuxtemps, in Vienna in 1834. But its official entry into the repertory is usually dated from 1844, when the 12-year-old Hungarian prodigy, Joseph Joachim, performed it in London under Felix Mendelssohn. Joachim made the Beethoven concerto his signature piece over his 65-year career, composing two sets of cadenzas for it. In turn, his identification with it influenced the concertos that composers wrote for him, including Brahms, Schumann, and, to a lesser extent, Dvorak. The Viennese-American violinist Fritz Kreisler, 1875 to 1962, was beloved not only for his playing, but also for the many charming compositions he left for his instrument. Kreisler's cadenzas for the Beethoven concerto were written at the age of 21, before he had publicly performed the piece. They are frequently played because, and here we apologize to the ghost of Franz Clément, of the musical depth they bring to what can be an empty display of technique. When in the first movement cadenza, Kreisler sets the end of the orchestral introduction against the beginning of the second theme, without, as the Russian virtuoso Nathan Milstein observed, killing either melody, one can imagine Beethoven himself muttering, Zum Donnerwetter. Why didn't I think of that? Incidentally, Beethoven hated bad cadenzas enough that in his later piano concerto No. 5, he wrote his own right into the score. Jean Sibelius, 1865-1957, Symphony No. 2 in D major, Opus 43. Sibelius's biographer Carl Eckmann preserves a revealing discussion between the Finnish composer and the Austrian symphonist Gustav Mahler. On the essence of the symphony, I said that I admired its severity and style and the profound logic that created an interconnection between all the motives, remembered Sibelius. Mahler's opinion was just the reverse. No, the symphony must be like the world. It must embrace everything. This dates from 1907, while Sibelius was working on his most classical symphony, the Third, and Mahler on his most colossal, the Symphony of a Thousand. The Second Symphony occupies a pivotal position in Sibelius's output. Composed in 1901, it stands at the beginning of a new century, one that would find the aphoristic style foreshadowed here more to its taste than the Mahlerian epic. Like Tchaikovsky, and unlike most European contemporaries, Sibelius saw no philosophical contradiction in composing both symphonic poems in the Liszt tradition and symphonies in the Beethoven-Brahms tradition. Fired by Finnish nationalism, he began with the more subjective symphonic poem. In On Saga, Finlandia, et al., he developed the compositional technique to create objective works with an interconnection between all the motives. While the First Symphony of 1897 retains the outlines of the Tchaikovsky model, the Second begins a transformation, completed in the Seventh Symphony, in which rhetoric, emotionalism, traditional form, and even breaks between movements would be stripped away, leaving a cool and compact 20-minute essay. The Second is far from that yet, but the beginning of the process is seen in the bridge joining the scherzo to the finale, in which the finale theme is evolved, and in the tightly organized first movement. Here, not for the last time, Sibelius put a pigeon among the critical cats. It still resists analysis. Several themes are set forth. A dance-like woodwind figure, followed by a gentle horn rumination, a bassoon fanfare leading to an unaccompanied recitative in the violins, a bucolic oboe melody accompanied by flute trills and sighing strings, and after some lively pizzicato, a high woodwind call consisting of a long-held note and a flourish. Given the extensive development, they are restated in a different order. First the brass take up the fanfare and harmonize the violin recitative, and the dance theme is then combined with the bucolic melody. What is unusual is that the return of the home key of D major, after the development, is unprepared. Then, the repetition of the beginning is condensed. This disguised recapitulation blurs the form, distressing analysts, if not the average listener. The symphony retains, thanks to tireless scholarship, of which Sibelius would not have approved, some programmatic baggage. The second movement originated in sketches for two unfinished tone poems, one in which Don Juan meets death, hence the gloomy bassoon melody, and the other based on Dante's Divine Comedy, ditto the pianissimo string chorale, originally designated Christus. Also, the finale's turbulent and obsessive third theme, with its accompanying scales, was conceived as a memorial to the composer's sister-in-law, who had committed suicide. In this context, the life-affirming climax has even greater significance.